Smith, Librarian Emeritus. Miss Smith, can you tell me about John Riddington?
He was too florid, and he was a newspaper man and a journalist, and you know.
He was from Manitoba, wasn't he?
Well, he really was from Cornwall. You know, his people were Cornish, but he worked in Manitoba for Sifton.
He worked on a Manitoban.
Yes, and he was all mixed up with the Dukobors. You know, he had mm-hmm. so he knew a lot about the Dukobors from his early days. You know, and their relationship, mm-hmm. and so on, bringing the Dukobors in.
That's right. He was down in Carberry. Yeah, where the Dukobors mm-hmm. were. Mm-hmm. Was that when I was mm-hmm. reading about it?
And when he came out here, of course, there are all kinds of wonderful stories about when he was, became librarian, you know.
Yes.
He and Dorothy Jefford and so on. And then he, I know this is not on your point at all, but...
Not at all. It's all, everything is relevant.
But Mr. Riddington really had a vision about librarianship. And some of the men, like the men at the University of Alberta, was far more of a scholar, you know, and a collector than Mr. Riddington ever was. But Mr. Riddington had a kind of vision about things.
Mm-hmm.
And so UBC really did very well because of that. You know, where the some of the other libraries were not going ahead. And he went down and took one of those short courses at Albany.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in touch with a lot of the people who were key people in the American Library Association, and he kept that up, and he always went to the ALA and so on, and then when the PNLA was formed, and the PNLA did a great deal for British Columbia,
mm-hmm.
you know, the American Librarians and the intercourse and interchange back and forth. And so he had great ideas about what we should be doing, but you know how some of the professors would puncture a lot of these things that are a bit visionary.
Mm-hmm.
And Lemmy Robertson, just this all will be for you only. This is not going to be, you're not going to quote me on this.
No.
But he just would, and Dr. Ashton, you know, they would just puncture Mr. Riddington at every opportunity. Oh dear. He had a hard time.
I think there's a great tendency on the part of some people to look, if you present a plan, not to take it and forward it, but mm-hmm. to squash it.
Mm-hmm.
Like sort of, I think it's a critical faculty mm-hmm. that they develop in their scholarship that mm-hmm. they carry over into life.
Well, certainly because he didn't have his degree and so on, they just looked down on him. And yet, he did a wonderful job for the library.
He didn't have a degree. Did he have a BA of any sort?
He didn't have a BA at all. He didn't have any university work.
But he had a course in Albany.
He had a course in Albany, which is just because in those days, a lot of the library schools were not attached to universities. You see, they took people from high school, you might say, like Madison, mm-hmm. Wisconsin did, and... Albany did, and then later on, you see, the Albany school moved down to Columbia, and they became the Columbia University.
Well, the Albany school was Dewey's own, wasn't it?
Originally, yes, and it took time, you know, for these things to change, but they did, and the number of the schools which started off as either in public libraries or, you know, something like that, state libraries, and.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't demand university degrees, either folded up or became affiliated with the university or were taken over by universities. But at any rate, Mr. Riddington, through his contacts there, realized the value of collecting material and used to get, one reason why we're so strong in government publications is he used to get 30 mail bags full from the university, from the Library of Congress when he'd come back, you know. And he really, if you wanted things, he would go and get them. It was really marvelous.
I think the library came out just very well, unexpectedly well, in the Williams report. Remembering
not unexpectedly well to me at all. Like, he didn't even know a lot of the things. Now, the Williams report made me kind of peeved because there was so much that he missed entirely.
But it's interesting. He really had a tremendous respect for the work going on in BC.
Yes, but he didn't begin. There was lots of stuff that he. Oh goodness! I wish I'd really talked to that man.
You mean you didn't talk to him?
Well, I did, but for a minute or so, and I really didn't tell him very much because I didn't want to, you know, be saying how much we had and sort of blowing our horn. But really, I should have. I realize now because he just missed great areas of material, and he had such a short time.
Yes, that was true. Well, he made this very clear, and actually, the report did a lot for Canada because it really woke everybody up. So maybe it was, as he said at the beginning, it was less rather than more.
And of course, if you look at took that in connection with several of the other reports, you notice UBC came up pretty high in all of them. So that if you balanced them all, I think we stood up very well indeed.
Oh, very well indeed. Comparatively speaking, it really moved along. I mean, you sense a moving person behind it all. You felt, when did Mr. Riddington, he began with the beginning?
He began with the beginning, practically. The story always was, you see, they had all these packing boxes and so on, and Mr. Riddington came in and he was opening up. Well, he immediately wasn't going to open up packing boxes himself, so he got somebody else, and then he got Miss Jeffrey to do the flunky work and so on and so forth, you know. But at any rate, he did come in quite early, and he did go on and take this course so that he had some idea of what he was trying to do. And we did get, and I think we were extremely fortunate that we were one of the very first that adopted the Library of Congress classification, you know.
Genius.
And that was smart of him.
Saved hundreds of
thousands of dollars. Because though the Library of Congress classification is far from perfect, I do think, and I'd worked in public libraries with the Dewey, and I still think the Library of Congress is much better for the university.
Yes. It's the only one now. Even the entrenched ones are changing.
And they're spending. The ones that I was in a lot of places where they were changing over and spending years and years doing it at cost of millions, you know. It was just terrible. And you get so many things that go along with it with the Library of Congress. So that really was quite wonderful.
That was his idea?
That came his idea from the beginning.
After being in Albany,
I suppose.
See, Toronto's.
Toronto was just hopeless. I mean, don't ever quote me on any of these things. But I went back to Toronto in the 40s and so on, and you just couldn't believe it. And Dr. Wallace told me, a reference librarian, he didn't like reference librarians, do you know, there was a woman there when he came, Stuart Wallace, that he didn't like at all. They couldn't get along. He said, all right, what do you want to be called? And she said, I'm called the reference librarian. Okay. Well, she can go and sit in her corner and be the reference librarian. And he had nothing more to do with her and never did anything. And there was no reference librarian, there was no reference work. And there never was any reference work. They had until Blackburn went in. Because when I went down there, there were two girls and they ran a little cubbyhole and they ran interlibrary loans, and that was called the reference.
And in the 40s.
Oh, this was on 40s and 50s, you know, there was nothing.
Shocking.
And, how do you get your reserve books? Well, any books that the students call up from the stacks, they just go on reserve. That's it called reserve, you know. You just couldn't believe the things they did in Toronto. But, of course, the students depended largely on their college libraries, you know,
yes,
small college libraries.
Yes, they'd have to have a library like that.
Well, But I mean, Mr. Riddington did have even a small collection, at least was a working collection, and the students used it tremendously.
Who did the first selecting for you? There was a story about somebody who ended up in a...
Oh, yes, Dr. Gerald of Princeton, mm-hmm. who was a real scholar, the librarian at Princeton, was abroad, and he was commissioned to buy our foreign books, French and German. And that was in 1913-14. The summer of 1914 was over there. And we never did get our German collection.
Oh, you didn't get
No.
them.
We never. They got our French material, but we didn't get our German collection at all. It got held up in the war, and we never did get it afterwards. And the there may have been a bit come through, but I mean, the real collection didn't come through. And Gerald was held up and incarcerated, apparently, for a bit till he proved he was an American citizen, and so on, and got out very... Then his son, I remember years ago, well, later, back in, oh, I suppose the 50s, 40s or 50s, taxi out at the front door, a young man came in. It was Gerald's son. He was out here. He was making a whizzing visit around, so he thought he'd come up and see the library that his father had.
Oh, isn't that charming? Sort of,
yes.
That's a lovely story. Nearly gone yeah. to jail for it.
And so our collection was quite lopsided, you know, because of the war, First World War. It just stopped, you might say. And they had most ambitious plans, and the... some of the very illustrious men in Europe were supposed to come over and be professors and so on. All of that was knocked on the head.
Tell me, was there conscious efforts to collect rare books
no.
in any period?
Not right. No, not for a long. No, there wasn't. You know about the Chain books and the Stedman boys.
The which one?
Chained books.
I know about the Chained books.
And the gift of, they were the gift of the Stedman.
Yes.
And, you know, they were students here. And they were both brilliant science students.
Mm-hmm.
They were, I think they were chemistry. I'm not positive now, I've forgotten. And one of them died very young. And the other one, who was over in England, gave these books in memory of his brother.
Ah, yes.
And they could pick them up, you know, for very little then. And it was really wonderful for us to have
in
Kinabula.
Sort of the first...
These were the among the very first gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had, of course, Bill Gibson has sort of grabbed all a lot of these famous medical things that were given to us, you know. They've gone over, I think, to the...
They've gone to the Woodward.
Woodward Library.
Talked to Mrs. Yandel about that and said, how do you feel? She said, it's all right, because they're being used there.
And they're well cared for and everything.
Very.
Mm-hmm. But they, of course, Anne came in so late, you know, after all of this, that she doesn't get emotionally involved with any of the... early things at all.
Yes, well, this is what I want to hear about the emotional involvement.
Oh, no, it's all right, because the special collections, as much as it was any, was I looked after, you see. With
this is it. Therefore, you looked after.
But there were no, we never had anything that was called special collections, really, till actually Mr. Harlow was the first one that called it special collections and really set up a policy about it and so on. But Dr. Lamb, I would say the things came along, and Mr. Riddington liked to get special gifts, you know, and he tried to, and the Audubon birds thing, you know, that big
yes.
gift, well, that was, oh, you've no idea how much work that took to raise that $5,000 or $8,000 or whatever it was that in the Depression days. It was fantastic, you know, because people weren't library minded anyway.
What made him decide he wanted it?
Well, he felt it was a wonderful thing to have, and he just felt it was something we had to have for some reason or other, and he started out. Now, I might get a hold, Miss Hearsay was the his private secretary, And she gets quite hot because when everybody gives Mr. Harlow the credit for everything, because she said, if you knew what Mr. Reagan did.
Well, this is what I would like to know.
And so I think I will, I'll drop her a note. She's down in California. And see if she can remember.
Well, I can perhaps I could.
I haven't got her address, but I'll give, Miss Lanning will have it.
Miss Lanning, okay.
Yes, I have Eve Hearsay.
Eve?
Eve Hearsay.
H-E-A-R-S-E-Y.
Yes.
Right.
And she's down in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles. Right.
And Miss Lanning will be the one. She knows her address. I must say I've lost it. But Miss Hearsay could certainly tell you a lot about those early gifts in the days of Mr. Rington.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was his secretary. She typed all the letters. And
I think the letters are there.
Are they?
Are they ever?
yes. Mr. Rington. Well, let me tell you, I blessed Mr. Rington many a time. Everybody used to curse at the time. Because everything Mr. Reed, every time he went to a meeting, he came back or he had a memo, you know, and everything was committed to paper. But afterwards, that was just a godsend.
Yes, it is.
And Kalam never put a single thing down on paper.
Ah, yes.
And you can't find a record of anything.
That's true. I've already become aware of this. Neil Harlow, on the other hand, was a paper man, too. There's quite a bit of his.
Yes, there'd be quite a bit of his, and he insisted on very detailed monthly reports from all of us.
Right.
We just had to give him everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he even set down a pattern of how we had what we had to put in our reports and how to submit it. So that every time I breathed, or anybody in any of the reference department, you'll find it all there.
This is Mr. Harlow.
My reports for Mr. Harlow,
yes.
Which you see covered the medical library and the special collections and, you know, everything practically except circulation and cataloging. And how we read. Well, now, before Mr. Reagan left, Roby Reed was a great friend of the library, you know, and had always been, he was a member of the Board of Governors and so on and so forth, and had always been interested in the library. And he had this splendid collection. But he wanted various things. He had a catalog of all the dealers' catalogs he clipped out, and he kept track of all the prices, and which was a wonderful thing. But you know, a man doing this for his own interest in the evening can do it. But can you imagine a librarian having time to...
You mean he wanted this continued?
He wanted this continued.
Whew.
For everything, you see, for all Canadiana. And he had a collection that was right across Canada.
Yes.
Now, a lot of the stuff for the real Maritimes went down to Nova Scotia, if I remember correctly.
Did he decide that?
Yes. No, I think he decided that it didn't come to us. Because, you see, he and Judge Howie came from the Maritimes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, didn't you?
No.
Oh, well, one was conservative, one was a liberal, and they were law partners.
Yes, I remember that. I knew that, but
yes.
I didn't know they both
And
came
they
from
both
the
came from the Maritimes.
I knew Mr. Reed did. I didn't know Judge Howie did.
I think so. Now, you bet. Well,
no,
you
not,
don't you I check me up. Check
I,
me up.
I haven't really read the history of Judge Howie yet.
But I think I'm correct in saying that. But I might be wrong. So
I'll
you
check,
check
it.
You check it. Don't take anything. I've just been reading. I just got from Sam that other thing, you know, the As We Remember or something.
Oh, yes,
and
that's right.
I said, you've got some law mistakes in there, you know. Because,
really?
Because you know, if you're 90 years old, you forget. And so on. And that's the way with all of us. So it could be.
Who wrote that?
Marion Gilroy and Sam Rostein, you see, edited that.
That's right.
You know, this business of...
I've got the book, I didn't realize there were a lot of mistakes in it.
No, well, most people, I don't think hardly anybody will realize it unless you...
Are there any mistakes affecting the university that you...
Oh, I just skimmed through it very lightly. I wasn't paying any attention to that.
I'm sort of trying to keep track of all of the things. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
But I was just, all I meant was that when people are older,
they forget.
You forget.
Indeed.
And I used to have a marvelous memory, and it's simply gone. So check anything that you doubtful about at all. Because I see that Helen Stewart has made some mistake about her own PhD, even.
Really?
Yeah, she's graduated from, she took her PhD at Chicago, finished it at Chicago. She started at Columbia, and she finished it at Chicago. I'm sure of that. And she's completely forgotten, just said she got to Columbia.
Do you suppose they taped it and missed it?
Yes, well, they taped it. But how would they, no, I think that Ms. Stewart might well have forgotten. I mean, this is, one
yes,
just has the weirdest lapses. I hate to say it, but it's perfectly true. I had a phenomenally good memory, and it's just terrible now. It's most humiliating.
Well.
So, be warned. Well, at any rate, Judge Howie's collection, as you know, was on the, in depth, a small, very good collection on the Pacific Coast
yes.
explorers, you know, a maritime exploration
mm-hmm.
particularly, whereas Reed's collection was across Canada and not in such depth. You know, and the more overland.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
so they complemented one another very
well.
Nicely. And Mr. Reed, Mr. Riddington, you know, sort of encouraged Mr. Reed to think of us, and Judge Howie too. But whether they would have, I don't know, I'm by no means sure he would have given it to us if it hadn't been for Kay Lamb. And Kay was one of Roby Reed's pet students, you know. Oh, he was a very great friend. They were great friends right through. And so when he came back from abroad and with his PhD and depression years and so on, and there was sort of nothing, he kind of worked for Mr. Roby Reed. And actually, I heard that and Roby Reed, of course, was, you know, he was influential in politics behind the scenes and so on. And that's really, nobody comes out and says it, but really that's, I think, with, you know, with the right friends of the right places, how he got the librarian, became the provincial librarian. Because he never had any library training or anything, you know. But he was a historian, and he was well trained as a historian, and he was interested in BC history and so on. And he was a great friend of Roby Reed, so he always, you know, sort of encouraged him to think of UBC. And it really, in the end, when they knew Mr. Riddington was going, I'm sure it was Mr. Reed that, and some of those people who were on the board that got Kay Lamb into the job as
mm-hmm.
librarian here,
mm-hmm.
and all the things they're never told in public, but because he still had no library training. And by this time, you see, we had hoped we'd have somebody of professional training, but I knew that he was coming long before it was ever announced. So I managed to get in a few good licks on him to
mm-hmm.
get him to do various things that for the library and for the profession when he was still over in Victoria, you know, the provincial librarian, which worked out all right because he was, he knew that he didn't have his professional training, and he was sort of, I think, a little bit modest about things just then. And shy about taking over. And when he came over, he just kept on with Mr. Reed and persuaded him. And it was catalog was the real stumbling block for years, because Mr. Reed was bound somebody's going to keep up that catalog. And Kay just knew he couldn't do it. But when that came to us, and then he also got Judge Howie to give his collection.
This was Kay Lamb.
Kay Lamb. So the biggest accession, really, was the Howie Reed collection.
Oh, yes, that's the star
that,
in
that
the special
was really
collections.
And that is due to Kay Lamb.
Kay Lamb.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Riddington started, and he was interested, But I would give the real credit to Kay Lamb, because I really am quite sure it never would have come to us if it hadn't been for Kay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this was just the darling of his heart. And while nominally it was under me and so on and all these things, I may say that nobody had anything really to do with the Harry Reid collection except Kay. And we put all our other special collection stuff in there.
Where was it housed?
Let me see. I guess you can, the Kay Brown cave. Have you got the... Now, the librarian's office was still... That's okay. It was still like that. The librarian's office is there. And then the next part, the outer office, was there. But there was a wall... I guess about where the wall is now still. But beyond that, on the window side, there was the catalog department. And that stretched over. That was the catalog and mending and everything all back there. And then there was an aisle down, not exactly where the aisle is now. It was farther over here. And there was our tea room. We called the Kay Brown Cave because there was somebody here, a Miss Kay Brown Cave. Oh, there's a whole story back of that. But anyway, that had no outside windows at all. And later on, after the wing ratted, the catalog department was moved. All that part was made into the Harry Reid collection. It went from the other office just right into the Harry Reid collection for years. That was that whole part, the part that's Mr. Hamilton's office, the part that's Bill Bell's office, all the rest of that.
And that was housed.
That was the Harry Reid, and all the collection
just
was stuffed
Harry
in.
Just the Harry Reid, or all the?
Oh,
specials?
All the stuff. But you all see, the Harry Reid was 99.9% of it. You know, there wasn't that much. There were a few bays of other
materials.
Anything else? The chain books
King
and
of
the,
Siam,
yes, and the all those things. You know, those little bamboo things. And well, no, some of those went into the safe. I guess that's true.
This is what I wondered.
Yes, we had the vault, and a lot of that stuff was in the vault too. That's quite true. The King of Siam stayed in the vault for a long, long time. We didn't have space for it, actually, in the Harry Reid. But it was all supposedly under the same...
So it was in the cage, in the vault, or
in the, well,
the special
there was
room.
The Harry Reid collection, and there were the odd things in the Harry Reid collection, the chain books and so on, but all the uncatalogued stuff, and oddments and so on, were all in the vault. And the vault was where is now the Xerox room.
Oh yes.
All there was.
Were students allowed to look at these things, or were they more or less under lock and key?
Well, we kept a fair amount of stuff. For instance, we had in the vault. We had, for instance, all the. Colophon and all the, you know, books on private presses. I mean, the rare ones, you know, and valuable stuff. And I remember that Bob Reed, when he was a student, you know, the one who's done all the printing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got him interested in private presses, and I used to get him everything out of the vault for him. He read through just about everything.
I suppose it was small enough that if a student really showed interest, he could look at almost anything that was there by special arrangement.
If you were sure, they were careful and
that's
so on.
That's
yes,
what I mean.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because you could still
you
watch.
Could, yes, you. But we were a lot more strict in those days than they are now.
Indeed.
I mean, you see, now anybody gets anything. But not in those days. They were very...
Yes, it's amazing.
I mean, everybody... There are all kinds of things that are just allowed to circulate. Like, and I just cringe when I think of these... I see some of these definitive editions, which seems to me just awful, just circulating as if they were paperbacks.
Special collections is careful.
Yeah, special collections
are
putting
restrictions on to education students coming in to do themes, you know, on Johnny.
Well, they
McDonald's
used to. You see, when special collections were started, they wouldn't let any of those people in. You had to be a bona fide student, and it wasn't for undergraduate essays.
No, this
at
is
all.
Not either.
It's you know, you had to be for genuine. I mean, there were mostly the history students or people with serious graduate study.
That's right.
And
this is still the
is
policy
it?
Up there.
I thought they had relaxed it a great deal.
Well, they did, and now they're tightening
tightened
it up
again. Yeah.
For one thing, nowadays you can get Xerox copies. Of
yes, of so many things. Yes.
So that you can actually,
yes.
if it looks as if a run of something's
yes.
going
yeah.
to happen, you can take it down
yeah.
and get it very carefully
yeah.
Xeroxed.
Yes. And which makes sense, you know. I mean, the
yes.
Xerox is just a. Oh, Dr. Lamb used to always say, if we only could let them have everything they wanted, you know, by Xeroxing, the professors, all anything they wanted, we could have Xerox the article and send it over and keep all our periodicals in the library.
That's
and not
more and more now.
But they just started letting them go holus bolus. Yes. And of course, our thing, they're. Oh, there are great gaps now. You've lost so much.
Okay, some of the periodical losses are irreplaceable.
They are.
Really
there are just piles of things
me.
That are absolutely irreplaceable.
Mostly,
it's shocking.
Mostly things you wouldn't even think about. But
I know.
You know,
I know.
Unruns, periodical
I know.
Runs. It's
I
a
know.
Disaster.
It certainly
but
is.
Mind you, Xeroxing is going to save that situation.
Yeah, I know they're doing
if they're
not.
Short. They just have to send off to Columbia or Harvard or somewhere
Although
else.
The trying to change the copyright law now, you know, the publishers are so furious
I've
about the use of Xerox.
I've just written a whole 20-page article on copyright.
Well, copyright is really a burning question,
I
isn't it?
I doubt very much that they're going to get anywhere because it's too late. They're
well, that could be.
To close
yeah.
the door. Mm-hmm. Too late. The thing is that now they've had it because in addition to Xerox, there's the
all Taiwan.
IBM machines. You
yeah.
can press a button in California and get hard copy
yeah.
and from New York, just like that. I mean, when you have that, copyright's out the window. I think they'll have to have another method of paying authors.
I think they will, too, because things are getting... I quite believe you that they're really out of hand.
It's hopeless to keep control. Mm-hmm.
And
but
all the stuff that came from Taiwan, you know, they were reprinting things
madly. Mm-hmm.
And the professors here were just having their students order them, like...
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. If it's there. I mean, the students don't understand copyright, and I don't blame them. I mean, they want the information.
They
can't see why they can't have it. And I must confess that the way the world is, I don't see why they can't have it either. But you've got to make sure that somebody gets paid.
Yes. Well, you see, they weren't. The authors weren't getting paid at all. Dr. Lamb really did do a very great deal for the special collections.
Now, when you have Dr. Riddington. Had contacts with Mr. Reed, with Judge Howie
and Mr. Reed.
And Mr. Reed.
But, yes, he did. But they had more respect for Dr. Lamb. You know, they were lawyer,
because
trained
he
lawyers.
He was a scholar, I suppose.
Yes, because he was a scholar. And they'd both known him from the time he was a boy and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was quite a different feeling. And he had taken his PhD over in London. So, excuse me.
Full of talk and
yes, Mr. Riddington's relationship with the president was very good. Dr. Klink, first of all, I suppose, as far as I know, he got along fine with Dr. Westbrook, but that was so very early, you know, in just such a short time. But it would be Dr. Westbrook that authorized him to go down to Albany and so on,
yes.
you see. And Dr. Westbrook, as far as I know, shared the modern attitude towards the library, because he came from Minnesota, where they had a good library,
yes.
You know.
Very good.
There's Westbrook Hall there.
Yes.
When I went there, I was so pleased to see Westbrook Hall. You know?
Charming.
And so he didn't want the old-fashioned. He wanted a good modern library, properly run. And Dr. Klink was very fair and very conservative. You know, but he always, I think, tried to be fair to the library. Now,
did he attract gifts to the library at all himself?
No, Dr. Klink was a very, you mean Mr. Biddington?
No,
or
Dr. Klink.
No, Dr. Klink was a very, very reserved man. Mm-hmm. And very reserved. And he, I got to know him very much better after he retired. I saw quite a bit of them, you know. But, and of course, Beth was one of my best friends, mm-hmm. so that that way I really saw more of him. But he was very austere, and I think being an agriculture grad in science, you know, rather than in the humanities and social sciences. Now, this is purely a personal estimate, you mm-hmm. understand, mm-hmm. something I don't think I've ever said before, but I always felt that he probably was felt at a disadvantage, you know, and was scrupulously fair, despite all the things in the 30s. There were some awful rows, and I must say, when a few years ago, and I thought it was awful when they revived some of this, but I guess it was Dr. Klink's death last year, and I was furious about the paper. I thought it was very bad taste, because there were some bitter rows and some awful things said by some of the people in
the
humanities.
I remember reading about this.
Well, it was, you have no conception of the bitterness. This was in about 1930-31.
About the agriculture.
And you see, the agriculture really never got, I mean, he was scrupulously fair. But what these people didn't think and didn't realize is, if you offer a course, it costs so much whether you have one student or 100 students.
Okay.
The only difference is the duplication, for instance, and the number of books and so on, you know. You have to have, the basic cost is just the same. And if you're going to have a school, mm-hmm. you can't just say, because you have a small school, it's going to cost very little. And they felt that the arts were just being very badly treated. But I don't honestly think that was so, because what I know of Dr. Klink, he was scrupulously fair, and he bent over backwards over and over again not to. But he was so austere that, for instance, the Rifles wanted to give a lot of money to the university.
Yes.
Oh, yes. And he wouldn't have it, you know. He was... you see, that was liquor money and so on.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, that would have started a whole chain of gifts. He was so upright and austere and very... he lived what he believed.
And I suppose he couldn't have extended the thought that it might have been... You know, liquor money, but still,
no,
put it to good use.
Yes,
anyway.
Well, I mean, the rest of us, we would have been glad to have it at any circumstance. I'm sure we could have had a lot of money. But, you know, if he had had Dr. Mackenzie's attitude,
yes,
you see, I'm sure there would have been lots of stuff funneled in here. But
because there's a very interesting pattern, this is one of my interests in working it, is that the gifts to the university at a time when other universities were attracting gifts, there's a pattern of not having as many as you'd expect, and then suddenly a great spurt of gifts.
That's after Dr. Mackenzie came.
Yes, yes.
Well, Dr. Mackenzie was just as different as
And he attracted gifts.
And he went out after them.
Yes.
And I'm very fond of Dr. McKenzie, but he's an opportunist, you know.
Oh, sure he is.
And Dr. Klink was not. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was an upright, severe person. The place was well organized and well run and very economically run. I mean, they mm-hmm. certainly never wasted any money, which you couldn't say later, I must say. But there were all kinds of queer things that happened later on. But
it's strange to have gifts to a library missing over a period. Not quite missing, but not as profuse as in other places.
Well, mind you, we always got gifts. All came in always, all through the back door. People constantly gave us stuff.
Uh-huh. I've seen the list.
Oh, well, just piles and piles of things.
But the spectacular ones came.
But the spectacular ones. I mean, for instance, people would come, the men would often come up to the desk. Well, I'd say, oh, well, listen, if you've got these files, now, for heaven's sake, give them to us and let us do what we want. And they might fill in our files of periodicals.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you see, the way we bought new periodicals was that Roland and Mr. Riddington and I would meet together. And later on, Roland, Mr. Harlow and I. And all the professors would send in their lists and so on. And then Roland and I go over everything. And I'd check everything from where it was indexed or not and what libraries held it. And he went from his knowledge of the importance of the periodical. And we all got together. And then we vote on what were the things that were the most solid and the longest lasting and our needs. And the particular
best collection in Canada.
Well, we've got a good collection.
Not the biggest, but
it's a pretty good solid collection, and we had to temporize between immediate needs and long-term
future.
Things, the future.
Really,
and
marvelous.
And there were a lot of things we'd like to have done that we couldn't do because we
money.
Couldn't get people. Lack of money, and also the lack of policy. You know, if we could only have said, well, now we are going to develop the Pacific Ocean, the Pacific Rim, you know, we should be doing this and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we could have gone ahead, but we did what we could. Mm-hmm. And we did the Commonwealth.
Very high quality, though.
Yes,
it really is.
Well, we tried to get things, but it always went. You see, there were practically always just the three of us that were
always
there.
That's incredible, you know. And they had such a long run. That's the other thing that's so marvelous about it. It's very consistent.
Oh, yes. But you see, Roland was marvelous at picking up things.
Mm-hmm.
And he really knew periodicals.
He
like
did indeed.
Nobody's business.
Like nobody in Canada.
Oh, well, I learned when I came in 1930, Roland and I worked till about midnight, night after night, for 1930, 1931. We got out that first list of periodicals.
Mm-hmm.
There had never been a list of periodicals. Nobody knew really what we had because Roland wouldn't list all the little periodicals that came in. Roland's idea of a periodical is the Cambridge Philosophical Society, which publishes about the transactions of the Cambridge Philosophical Society, which come out every 3 years or something, or proceedings, you see, which was really scholarly. But in the meantime, the students want all kinds of things
mm-hmm.
that are little Canadian stuff or this, that, or the other. And we may be getting them, but who knew whether we were getting them? They never checked them in.
Not
so
a periodical.
Roland and I just
wrote for
fought on this, you know, and finally persuaded them to get more things checked in. And then I wanted to know what we really had because nobody knew, and that's how we got that first list, and got things into. And I learned, but you see, I learned from him because the library schools really didn't do anything on periodicals and the history of periodicals,
mm-hmm.
and so I learned from him the sort of history of all the journals and the amalgamations and the back tracking and what joined and what separated and this that,
hard
and that
work,
and it was marvelous.
Mm-hmm.
In my first year of reference here, you see, mm-hmm. and that was a wonderful background.
Yes, it would be.
And we worked together, you see, through everything, all through with the reference work and periodicals, because the periodicals are just the backbone of your reference work. Periodicals and government documents.
Yes. Did you have any moments of excitement about anything coming to you in the way of, I'm thinking more of the special collections things.
No, because they are actually, we felt in those days that we had to get our bread and butter. It was so hard. You see, until Dr. McKenzie came, until after the Second World War, there was so little money. We never had enough money to buy anything, and we couldn't go out and get gifts. Now, what I did is, anybody I knew of, I always try to encourage them to give things to the library, and we'll just and permit us to deal with it as we can, you know, but always take it with a very gracious attitude that you're so grateful, because that'll bring on something else. Because when they started telling people we don't want it, I know of several people that have just been turned off completely, and they're not going to give anything more because
when did they do this?
Oh, when you got too organized, too mechanized, you know. There's,
I didn't
too
know
much
that. I thought that was against all sorts of university policies. You accept everything, hide it if you have to.
Well, but there were some of these little young men that came in. I think they've just done unutterable harm, really. I know quite a few people that are just browned off completely because the way they were treated, you know. Now, granted, maybe this particular gift wasn't worth a whoop. Okay, you take it. I always used to put it in the proviso that we will deal with it as we see fit. We're very glad to receive this, but you'll understand that it might be a duplicate or something. So if we could send it to another library or do something with it.
Of course.
And would that be all right with you? And practically everybody's quite pleased, you know.
Yes.
And then what happens to it is nobody's business.
Right, right. Yes, it's a great mistake to turn down gifts, because the man who gives you $10 this week may give you $10,000 the next.
That's right, exactly. And some of these people I know offered something and might have given some very good collections later on.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't now, because they were, you know, it just takes...
One man brushing.
Yeah, it takes such a little bit to hurt your feelings.
Yes, well, maybe this, you know, we might be able to get it back sometime. So
yes. But mind you, you won't. The trouble is, it's somebody that before you ever see it, because
yes.
You know, so many of the people, they send stuff to the library and they don't know about special collections.
That's true.
I'm talking about just sort of. They're just the machinery of the day-to-day.
They have already been written.
Yeah.
And people...
gifts would be noted in the librarians, especially in Neil Harlow's annual reports.
Yes, they are.
And that is after... It was not till his time that the gifts began to really flow in, because the combination of him as a librarian, interested in gifts and special collections, because you see, he'd been interested in special collections down in California.
And a place to keep them.
And a place to keep them. But we didn't even have a place to keep them for a long time,
and then,
you see.
Let's face it, lots more money.
Oh, right. Yes. And also, Dr. McKenzie, getting out into the community, you see, enlisting the whole interest of everybody. And we had very good public relations in those with Dr. McKenzie. So many of our graduates were on the newspapers and, you know, all over.
Mm-hmm.
And he charmed them all.
Mm-hmm.
And we really had, there was a real influx of gifts from then on.
Oh, yes.
Now, always through the back door, there were always lots of gifts coming in of minor things that just went in the stacks, but they were not, and files of periodicals to fill in our files.
Mm.
And all kinds of things like that. There was a constant stream, far more than most libraries apparently, because I've talked since to friends in American libraries and in other Canadian libraries, and they were very surprised, but we've always had a real inflow
of regular gifts,
but not outstanding. They were just...
I think probably, too, that it was pretty poor here during the Depression years.
So oh, terrible.
And the library suffered very badly.
Oh, dreadful. We all gave, the staff even gave of their salaries to maintain the circulation of the periodicals.
I remember reading that people donated their time.
Our time, well, of course.
Overtime for hours.
Oh, heavens, nobody ever thought about time. Well, as I told you, Roland and I worked till midnight.
Mm-hmm.
Night after night after night for over a year getting that list up, but I mean, time was never even considered.
Incredible devotion. I think it's wonderful.
But all the early librarians were very devoted, much more so, I think, than the most of the young people are today.
Oh, I think so. I think it's a different age, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You were very fond of Mr. Reddington, was he an easy man to get to know? Or?
Oh, I was dreadful to Mr. Reddington. When I think of how cheeky I was. One day he made me so mad, I just went down and just blew him up. Then I went up and I got mad and all over again. I went down and finished up and did another job on it. He was just terrible. Really, if anybody ever did that to me. Mr. Reddington, I can't say I was fond of him. I was very much aware of all his weaknesses. But for all that, I think he did a darn good job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think he had quite a devoted staff and... devoted to the work, not necessarily to him.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, I think we all supported him, and we never talked to him, because I remember once Hermina saying, you make me tired. Not one of you will ever criticize Mr. Reddington outside, you know, and while we might have pulled him to pieces inside, we really didn't outside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he had his weaknesses, no doubt about it, but I don't think he's ever been given credit for how much he did for the library and how much material he managed to bring in.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't all special collections material. I mean, we needed just the basic material for our library.
I think that's an extremely good point, and you mentioned that before, and I think that is the really
mm-hmm.
vital.
Mm-hmm. We needed periodicals, we needed government documents, and so on.
It would have been a terrible thing if you spent your budget, for example,
yeah.
on rare books.
Well, you see, that was the trouble. Like down the public library, before Mr. Robinson came, they had a dreadful public library, and they had all these collections of Elseviers and all kinds of rare editions and beautiful books that the librarian kept in his office,
right,
and just enjoyed.
Yes, and
I notice
even now that you can't browse in the Canadiana room. You're not allowed to browse. You have to call a book and sit. You can't just stand and look at things. It's rather interesting.
Well, they had to be and were a lot tougher than we were because, you just lose so much stuff. It's really awful.
Oh, yes.
And I must say, the thieving in our library has always been pretty bad, you know. The students really and they have such good taste. They always take the cream of the crop.
Yes. Mr. Rothstein was saying that you had to lock up the books written by authors who'd written a so-called hot book. Then everything would go. And he felt there should be a little sign saying, you know, this is not as hot as you think it is. Please don't steal it.
Well,
this is a very boring book.
Well, I don't remember ever feeling that there was very much that was not put on the open shelf. Lady Chatterley's Lover, for instance, back in the 30s, was not on the open shelves.
Well, I think theft is the main reason that that people keep that kind of book on the shelves. They just lose them.
And it was then, too, because you just lost them. But, of course, you'd also get into trouble. I used to always feel that it wasn't the students that you had to protect, it was the parents. I never worry half as much about students reading things as I do about their elders. And I think that holds good probably to today.
It's true. Poor parents. The literature that's coming out these days
depressing. Dr. Strassman's lecture the other day, I didn't think I could blush. And I felt awfully sorry for him, and he did it awfully well. And he did an awfully good talk on the, sort of current theater. But I'm very impressed by the young people. I think they take things extremely well, and I think they're very sensible.
Stride.
Well, that's quite right and helpful. I think it's very sensible. But, I've been no help to you at all.
Well, actually you have, because you've given me, I think, the keynote of what I wanted to hear about, what your decisions were, which is the important thing.
By and large, we just didn't have the money,
mm-hmm.
and the temper of the times was such that you couldn't go out and...
if you were asking for money, you had to spend it in a practical way.
Yes, and you couldn't...
First edition Shakespeare.
you just couldn't. Now, for instance, we could have had the Royal Society material if we'd only had just a little bit of money. We could have had John Sell Cotman's, all the Cotman's. We could have had a wonderful art collection. The Bulwers here had a wonderful library. And we could, if we could have paid a little bit, they were so hard up that they just would have, but they wanted to give it to the university. They couldn't afford to just give it, and of course the Americans snapped it up.
Mm-hmm. That's the story I wanted to hear.
Yeah. And there were more wonderful collections. Now,
who
they
got
wouldn't
that
have them.
Collection?
I don't really know. I don't know who it was who got that. But there were so many things. For instance, we should have had the Jess Chinese Library. This was the obvious place for it. If we'd only, and McGill wasn't keeping it up. And after all, McGill really wasn't really interested in it. And we just couldn't. We didn't have any money. So Princeton got that. But the Jess Chinese Library would have been a wonderful nucleus.
I just read about it last night.
Oh, well, that was always famous in Canada,
Yes.
And
and we lost, it was on deposit in McGill, wasn't
it? Yes.
Yes.
And we should have had it.
Yes.
Right from the beginning, because we were right on the Pacific. The Chinese colony was here and so on, And just... you couldn't get people interested, And of course, if we cut, now for instance, Dr. Clink had the bread and butter every day, just keeping the university open. In 1919, it was just like that, all but closed.
Almost lost.
Yes. It was just the barest chance that it was kept open. And, the people just were not library-minded or university-minded around here.
Well, it's a frontier.
It's a frontier town. Yeah. Well, I remember just a few years ago, I was back when I was at Brock, and I was visiting people in Hamilton, and they said when McMaster moved from Toronto to Hamilton, it took years and years and years before they could get the people in Hamilton a least bit interested in the university. Now, Hamilton's a wealthy place.
And it's an old town.
It's an old town.
They should have been. But I think that's really, really terrific. And just, it isn't so much that you expect to learn everything about something, but you want things to fill in gaps. And
I hope some of this will help you feeling about the library.
It does indeed.
And so on. But, and I'll be glad to talk to you anytime, about the library, because I have...
That's something else again.
It's very dear to my heart, if you can see.
Oh, yes.
But actually giving you... I was doubtful when you spoke, and I realized that, in actual fact, you'll get the important accessions and so on in Neil Harlow's report. You should also get when Les Dunlap was here, before Neil Harlow came, there is a policy report written of what we should collect and what we should not collect and what we should try to do. Have you seen that?
Yes.
And I don't, I'm afraid they haven't kept to it as well as they should.
No, they've changed it, I think.
But, well, I don't think they ever changed. I think they just
drifted off.
And I don't think they should have, because Les was, he'd worked in the Library of Congress, and he'd done a lot with special collections, you know, and he'd been in Columbia and so on, and he was a history man,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he really knew from working in big collections the importance of setting a policy, you know, and sort of keeping to it. And back in Queens, for instance, I was just horrified, and in Ontario, to find the way all these people are competing with the National Archives.
Yes.
There's no policy set up for Canada as to what should go to the National Archives, what should, and that people should be gentlemen of honor and send them and not try to grab everything for yourself.
Yes, it's true. It's hard to do, though, mind you. I have a very small number of original Riel papers, and I don't think I can ever bear to give them up, which is a terrible thing. I sort of feel, well, it'd be nice for my children to have.
But the trouble is that...
with copying, I've done Xerox copies for the Provincial Archives.
But you know, I think you're wrong.
I think I'm really wrong, too.
Because you feel that way. But what guarantee is that your children or your children's children will, today, your children may, but 9/10 of the time, what happens? I'm giving everything to the library or the museum and so on that I own.
I think probably one of the reasons I feel reluctant about these papers is that my family gave a good number of papers to the Manitoba Archives, and alas, they disappeared.
Oh,
and
no!
I don't think they've disappeared in the sense that they're not there, but they sort of never got cataloged, and when you went down to take a look, they didn't have them organized. And this was many years ago, and things have changed in Manitoba, and I expect they're probably right on the top file now. But my family had a slightly bitter feeling about this at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is probably one reason.
Well, let me tell you that people... Now, the real papers, you have a real reason. But human nature being what it is, anybody who ever gives you anything, whenever we had open house, everybody who came to the library wanted to see all the things that they had ever given.
I think that's quite true.
Actually, and it's terribly difficult. You know, I remember one man that used to drive us. There was one old lady, and she had some Bible that she gave. And she used to drive us
Come
crazy.
Up to look at it?
She always wanted to look at it. And there was one man who gave us, he was a crank of something, what was it? Some kind of a gadget of some sort or other. Anyhow, he gave it, and we had to take it. We took it anyway, and put it in the safe. Well, then when open house he'd come, and nobody had ever heard of it but me. I remember, and thank goodness I recalled it, and I managed to run down and get it for him, so he was happy. But you've no idea that...
I have an idea.
when you're on the inside, you know what is terribly dear to one person's heart. I know, because I've given lots of things to, and I'd like to know where some of my things are.
My really big problem, of course, is where they go. They don't really belong out here. They belong in Manitoba.
Oh, yes, they belong in Manitoba. Oh, certainly. Manitoba. Oh, that's quite right. I don't think you should give them out here at all. I don't think so. But
it's a temptation to do so, though.
Of course it is, but I don't think they should. This is the sort of thing, and the only reason I say that is that today... the younger people, now you may find, if you could only say, well, if your child was terribly interested, you ought to give it to her, or him, or whoever it is.
There's only one child in our family, not Susan. My own. a cousin's daughter who probably will someday. Also, the reason I have them is that my brother is a historian, and they came to the family because of him.
Mm-hmm.
And he had at one time, he was going to be Mr. Morton's successor, but he went into external affairs.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And he was Mr. Morton's prize student. I think maybe now in external affairs, he's sorry he didn't go into history after
Now, why hasn't he got them?
Well, just because he's in external affairs and traveling around
and so on. Well, has he got a family that would be interested?
No. There's only one member of the family that would. Well, they will, you know, they'll find their way to the right place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But
what I meant is that so often the next generation, there might be somebody, but after that, it's so likely just that nobody will care a scrap
That's
about it.
That's quite true.
And if you have it in a good collection that you know is well looked after.
As long as it's not, you know, duplicates and that sort of thing. But you see, this year is the first year that Riel has papers and things have been properly organized. So this is the year when they should go back.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I've been holding on all this time, thinking,
Well, I think you're wise to have held on, because unfortunately...
Oh, they got very neglected, those papers, in Manitoba in the early days.
Yes, yes.
They revived a few of them when they opened up the Black House. Some of the things came out, but some of them, just I don't know where they've gone. It really
Isn't that
very
awful?
Worrying.
Yes, and this, of course, is true. Like I was telling you about what happened with these other things, you know, right in the library.
Well,
and
you see,
and
the
little
university
young ones throwing them out.
Are sort of, you know, they just haven't had anyone to look at.
No,
but they will now.
But at least if stuff goes in, like we got all Mr. Riddington's papers, you know,
okay.
I said, well, now Muriel, do give me everything.
And
the
you
Mr.
get all
Enetta.
Those files of the minutes, I saw them all. And Mr. Riddington's papers, of course, are all sorted.
They sorted now.
Completely.
But I managed to get them to send as much as we could of Mr. Riddington's papers, you know, and so
sorted.
On.
And
we
indexed,
got to,
I might say.
Oh, is that
very
right?
Very good job.
But you'll have nothing of Kay Lamb. You have nothing of Kay Lamb.
Well, I've got a little sort of
a little bit, but not much.
But
because
I've got mountains of Dr. McKenzie's.
And Dr. McKenzie's.
Not all university,
but
some of them
mind
belong
you,
in the national.
But you see, we got to. I got Dr. McKenzie trained early. And he said, now you'll send everything to the library.
Yes,
And he has in all his royal commissions, and all these men, Angus. Everybody that sat in a royal commission, I asked them all to send all the original copies to
They're
us.
All there.
And, of course, they haven't been looked after. They weren't for a long time. But I felt at least even to have it.
But still, it's
Yeah,
there.
But even to have it.
It's
now,
terrific.
It's perfectly true that a lot of that stuff is just junk. But, you know, a lot of those briefs. But for a social historian, and so on, even just seeing a lot of the junk is can be useful and interesting.
I think it'd be very useful.
You know?
It needs now to
but
have
it has
the kind
to
of work that was done on the Riddington papers. It needs to be sorted and indexed. There's no question about it. All that has to be done. But it will come.
I used to feel it's better to collect all these things anyway.